The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
I think on balance, I like to think that I take a no holds barred approach to all of Biden's failures during these first 2 years. But once again, at the end of the day, or at least the midway point of this presidency, more accurately, I do think that everything, I think the turning point of this presidency was February 24, 2022, when Putin invaded Ukraine and Biden began to rally NATO to defend a democracy in the heart of Europe. And face down Putin. And from there, a lot of successes followed. Legislative victories that rivaled LBJ's, capped by the Inflation Reduction Act, defying the odds in the midterms. So I think Joe Biden does go into the third year of his presidency with the wind at his back.
I'm David Preece, publisher of Lawfare, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 20th, 2023. We have just ended Biden's first 2 years as president, and it's a great time to reflect back on the wild national security ride we have had. In fact, Chris Whipple has just done that by publishing his book, The Fight of His Life, Inside Joe Biden's White House, a deeply reported book that contains many interviews with Biden's inner circle. I talked with Chris about the transition from Trump to Biden, about Biden's decision to pull out of Afghanistan, about Russia's invasion of Ukraine, about the Biden administration's strategy of releasing intelligence before the invasion to try to both preempt the invasion and prepare European allies for what would come afterward, and much more. It's the Lawfare Podcast, January 20th, Biden's National Security Presidency so far with Chris Whipple.
Chris, I appreciate you coming on the podcast to talk about primarily your new book, the very first, very serious, in-depth, reported treatment of the first 2 years of the Biden presidency. People may know you better because of your work chronicling in both film and in book form the White House Chiefs of Staff and then the directors of Central Intelligence, CIA directors. What made you decide to do a much wider political study of one administration?
When people ask me, why did you write a book about the first 2 years of Joe Biden's presidency? My answer is, how could I not? I mean, Joe Biden and his team faced the most daunting array of challenges since FDR's time. A once-in-a-century pandemic, a crippled economy, global warming, racial injustice, the aftermath of a bloody insurrection on the Capitol. And, you know, so how could anybody with a political or storytelling bone in his body not want to tell that story, especially if you could have access to Joe Biden's inner circle, which I was able to get. So to me, it's not so much a history, political history, as it is a political thriller. I mean, this is a story that has no ending yet.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And I'll say it does read that way. You've written it in a very approachable kind of you're in the room where it happens style.
Well, it's great to hear this kind of you. Let me just add to that my previous books, you were kind to mention the gatekeepers and the spymasters on the White House Chiefs of Staff and the CIA directors, covered something like 100 years of history. This book covers 2 years, and yet this was a bigger challenge for me, believe it or not. And One reason is that this is the most battened down, disciplined, leak-proof, on-script White House in modern history, I think. They're not easy to get to. But second, writing about a White House in real time is an amazing challenge. I mean, it's like trying to design an airplane in mid-flight. You don't know where you are, or where you're landing, or what's gonna hit you next. A COVID variant will slap you in the face, and the next thing you know, you've got an invasion by a tyrant of a democracy in the heart of Europe, and you have to just kind of roll with all of that and figure out where you come out on the other side. But having said that, that kind of challenge provides an even greater reward when you pull it off.
Right on. And it definitely reads that way. That is, you're in the middle of a thread on Afghanistan or Russia, Ukraine, and suddenly a COVID wave hits, or suddenly there's protests, or suddenly there's an issue that is related to public relations. So we're not going to cover all of that, this being a national security law and policy podcast, but I do want to drill down on a few. And I really want to start with the fact that this administration might not have started at all in the way that it did due to the historically unique transition. Talk a little bit about Christopher Liddell, who's a name that many people still don't know, even though he played a crucial role in transitioning from the Trump administration into the Biden years.
It's an amazing story, David, and it was striking to me that no one else had told it. You know, we may think that there's been so much written about this fraught transition from Trump to Biden that there'd be nothing left to say. You'd be wrong, because I discovered, and as I started to report this, that it was so much worse than we thought, and it looked bad. It was bad enough, God knows, at the time, but it was much, much closer than we thought. The transition, the peaceful transfer of power from Trump to Biden, might never have happened if not for one obscure Trump staffer, a deputy White House chief of staff named Chris Liddell, who was born in New Zealand, came to the U.S., worked his way up to become CFO of both Microsoft and General Motors, ran Mitt Romney's transition. He was a Romney Republican. He wasn't crazy about Trump, but he wound up in the Trump White House, and he very nearly quit because of Trump's excesses. At one point, Liddell was about to quit when he was talked off the ledge by Josh Bolton, who was George W. Bush's second chief of staff. There was a small group of people, Bolton and a few others, who were kind of lifeline for Liddell, and they would talk him off the ledge every time he was about to quit, because they knew that Liddell was somebody who might, he was a voice of reason, one of the few inside the Trump West Wing. Mm-hmm. Well, in any event, Liddell was there when, as Trump kept threatening to not to respect the results of the election, he stayed, and he managed to carry out what was really a sub rosa operation under Donald Trump's nose and without his knowledge. He kept the wheels of the transition turning. And it's an absolutely stunning story. And as I say, there were moments where he was on the verge of quitting, when he was talked into staying. He nearly quit after the attempted insurrection on January 6th, along with many others who did quit, as you know. He was talked into staying, and on the morning of January 20th, 2021, he walked out of the West Wing, climbed into his 1960 Corvette convertible, drove down to the Southwest Gate, and tipped his fedora to the Secret Service and roared off down Constitution Avenue, having felt that he'd carried out the transition from Trump to Biden. Incredible story.
Two quick aspects of that. One is that it probably wouldn't have happened without the advice, the support, the influence of former Chief of Staff Josh Bolton, who was advising him during this time, as well as presidential transition guru and former Lawfare podcast guest David Marchik, and their role you detail, but also an issue I want to ask you about here, which is, was it merely because Trump was so distracted with the election and trying to manipulate the results of the election and argue that it was unfair, that essentially by not bringing things to his explicit attention, in a sense, Liddell acted kind of like Joe Hagan when he had been deputy chief of staff here, which is getting the business of the White House done, running the operations, and letting the president focus on the big shiny objects he wanted to focus on while the machinery of government continued. That is, was it a deliberate strategy to keep Trump focused on other things so that they could make sure that the machinery of government moved forward for the next administration?
I think the answer is yes. Partly Trump was distracted, and partly because he was up to his eyeballs, as we all know, and scheming and plotting and trying to corrupt his own Justice Department and install a new attorney general and people at the CIA and meddling with election results in various states and meeting with that Star Wars bar cast of characters of lawyers who kept coming and going. Partly it was that, but partly also the fact that Trump just didn't understand governance, period. He had no idea how the levers of power operated, no more that 4 years in than he did on January 21, 2017. So it was partly he didn't understand what a transition was. And also Chris Liddell, as somebody put it, it was a vivid metaphor. It's kind of like the eye of Sauron. As long as Chris Liddell stayed out of it, stayed away from the Oval Office and did his thing, Trump wouldn't interfere. Here's another part of it that is kind of astonishing, and that is Mark Meadows, the chief of staff, Trump's final chief of staff, who was complicit in almost all of Trump's nefarious deeds at the end, inexplicably turned a blind eye to, and more than turned a blind eye, he actually gave a wink and a nod to Liddell to go ahead with the transition. He just said, look, you know, you do what you have to do, just don't tell the boss. It's hard to explain, but in part I think it's just Meadows' fecklessness. He was a yes man to everyone, not just Donald Trump, and he let Liddell go ahead and do his thing.
Right on. And the one aspect of it may have been that, unlike decades ago, the presidential transition process now has parts of it that are a matter of law in terms of when memos must be produced and the kinds of things that go on behind the scenes. But you still raise an interesting question, which is someone who is so willing to skirt other issues and push the limits, in this case, basically let the transition go on.
Yeah, it's hard. It's really hard to overstate how close we came to the peaceful transfer of power not taking place. You mentioned that there are procedures and laws governing this, but at the end of the day, it's really still remarkable the extent to which this transfer of power we all take for granted comes down to the goodwill of a few people, of people who, with good intentions. God knows they were in short supply in Trump's final days in his White House.
There's one Washington institution, Chris, that most people aren't aware of, even a lot of Washington insiders, and you provide an exceptional window into. And that is the fact that for the last several transitions, the former chiefs of staff of the White House of both parties have gotten together in a meeting, or in the case of the most recent transition, in a Zoom call, to give advice to the incoming chief of staff, kind of pass on lessons learned, offer support, and indicate that we're all here for you. And in this case, if I remember correctly, it was almost all of the 21 or 22 former chiefs of staff. Only two or three didn't make it.
19 chiefs were on this call, yeah.
Okay. With your previous experience working with the chiefs of staff and speaking with all of them and putting that together and overlaying it onto the Biden experience with Ron Klain coming in, Do you feel that Ron Klain, in a sense, had a head start, that he had been forewarned about some of the issues that even he, with his experience, would not have known about the specific aspect of being the presidential chief of staff for the entire White House operation that helped him with this, as you put it, very challenging transition and beginning of the administration?
Well, to begin with, Ron Klain, I think every living White House chief of staff would agree that Ron Klain was the best prepared person ever to take on that job. And it's saying something, as you know, given the caliber of the people we're talking about. Klain had worked for 9 different White House chiefs of staff going back to his early days. But this Zoom call that he had on December 18th, a month before the inauguration, was really remarkable. It happened during COVID. This tradition goes back to Rahm Emanuel in 2008. That's when it began. And we mentioned Josh Bolten. It was Josh Bolten's idea to gather all the chiefs in the White House in his office. He was the outgoing chief, to give advice to the incoming guy, the new kid on the block. So it's been happening since then. And in this case, it was the first time it happened on Zoom. 2 of Trump's chiefs were there, John Kelly and Mick Mulvaney, not Reince Priebus or Mark Meadows, who, of course, was in the midst of trying to overturn the election. And it was fascinating because they all gave a piece of advice to Rahm. One of my favorite parts of it was LBJ's White House Chief of Staff, Jim Jones, who was 28 during the LBJ's final year in 1968. He's now 82 years old, and his piece of wisdom was take care of the president's rest. I'm 82 years old. I look at Joe Biden. I recognize myself. I see it in his gait. I'm an expert at tripping going up the stairs. This is somebody who really needs he needs to be taken care of. I used to see to it that LBJ had a nap every afternoon. You've got to take care of Joe Biden. And all of them gave advice all the way from Jim Jones to, as I say, John Kelly, who remarkably and maybe ironically offered the advice that you should always, I'm paraphrasing now, but make sure you follow the Constitution and obey the law.
Absolutely. There are a couple of big international stories that really center your narrative. And one of them I'd like to jump to is the pullout from Afghanistan and the very hectic experience in those final days. And in the book, you cite a prominent foreign policy expert who mentions that Biden and his team appeared to be in lockstep, which often is a good thing rather than having very different messages coming out of the administration on a contentious issue. But the danger is, as this policy expert put it, that there was an amazing amount of groupthink and no one was looking at the alternatives to a relatively smooth pullout. And I wonder if you can characterize that, especially in terms of the interactions that you got such a good window into about the senior most advisors to the president.
Well, the Afghan withdrawal, let me just say as a kind of overarching point before I get into the details, that I really look at this presidency as a kind of tale of two presidencies, the first year and the second. And the first year was, no doubt about it, the first year was really defined by the debacle of the evacuation from Afghanistan. The second year, I think, by the invasion of Ukraine by Vladimir Putin and Joe Biden's ability to rally NATO and face down a tyrant. But Afghanistan really triggered, as you know, a steady decline in Joe Biden's approval ratings and obviously had extraordinary consequences for the Afghan people. There were real differences of opinion. I think that the comment about groupthink was unfair, really, about Joe Biden's foreign policy and national security team, because it was certainly true that Lloyd Austin and General Mark Milley chairman of the Joint Chiefs and, of course, Austin's defense secretary, argued strenuously to keep a small force, you know, roughly 4,000, 4,500 or so troops, maintain this, what they considered a relatively small investment in keeping Afghanistan stable. Joe Biden, of course, came in determined, hell-bent on withdrawing from Afghanistan, but promised he would hear other points of view. They did many NSC meetings. They had a long one with Admiral Jim Stavridis, who was one of the characters in the book, who also argued for the proposition that we should stay with a small imprint in Afghanistan. They lost that argument, obviously. Joe Biden was not convinced. And it was, to me, fascinating because I got to spend a time with, I talked at length with Tony Blinken about this. I talked at length with General Mark Milley, who gave me a master class in his thinking on all of this. In the end, as Mark Milley described it in pretty compellingly, I think, he said that Joe Biden essentially said, look, the day he'd set a deadline for January 31st. And of course, prior to that, Donald Trump had set a deadline of May 1st for getting out of the country. Joe Biden argued that the day after that deadline, we would be back to square one, fighting a war against the Taliban. The Taliban would step up their attacks, and we'd have to increase troops all over again. It was a recipe for endless war. Milley said to me, conceded that he could not answer that argument. He could not persuasively argue that that wouldn't be the case. And so Milley, Austin, Stavridis, and others lost the argument, and the withdrawal proceeded.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information,
big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
Part of the issue that you develop, in part from your conversation with the Secretary of State, involves what was the intelligence picture about the possibility or the probability, and especially the speed of a potential Afghan government collapse. You have quite a contrast in people's memories on this between the Secretary of State and between Bill Burns and others. Can you characterize what each of them said about the intelligence on the Afghanistan government and where you come out after hearing both points of view?
So clearly, there was plenty of drama to the evacuation of Afghanistan, as we all know, watching it on television. But it turns out that there was also plenty of drama behind the scenes. Among Biden's advisors. Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, told me in no uncertain terms that everything they did was based on a fatally flawed intelligence assessment that predicted that the Afghan government and armed forces would be stable for 18 months. Well, this was news when I sat down with it was news to Bill Burns when I sat down with him, the CIA director, in his office on the seventh floor of CIA headquarters over at Langley. And we talked about this at length. And he said, no, look, we were clear-eyed. The CIA was about the fragility of the Afghan government and armed forces. And he said that especially if you pulled out two legs of the stool, as he put it, the American military and the American contractors, that was a recipe for quick collapse. Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had yet another version in which he said, no, the intelligence he remembered was that the Afghan government would last until about Thanksgiving. So they're all over the place. And I think that this was obviously part of the problem. If you look at it, it's pretty clear that the execution of the evacuation was based on the assumption that they had more time. We had only 700 troops on the ground to conduct that evacuation. That was the cap that Austin and Milley were operating under. it was based on a false assumption that the Afghan government would last.
Right on. Well, whether the historians who look back at this with even more full information than you were able to uncover characterize this as an intelligence failure or a policy failure or some degree of both, there is certainly a contrast with another story that you tell at length throughout the book, which is the awareness of what Russia was going to do in Ukraine and the unprecedented or virtually unprecedented willingness of the President of the United States personally to direct that intelligence be declassified and released to allies and also to the public to preempt a lot of Russia's planned shenanigans before the invasion. And I'm hoping by contrasting it with the Afghanistan pullout that you can shed some light on this. How extraordinary was that? And what aspects of it surprised you as you were interviewing the chairman and others?
Of course, I described the Afghan evacuation as a whole of government failure in which everybody did almost everything wrong. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it strikes me as you ask that question that in the case of Ukraine, it was almost the opposite, where everyone did almost everything right. And it began with the performance of the intelligence community and predicting what Vladimir Putin was up to. It rivaled the performance of the intel community during the Cuban Missile Crisis, when they were able to get stolen blueprints of the Russian missile sites in Cuba and U-2 flights and prepare JFK for what was happening. It was an extraordinary performance. So we had, the intelligence community had, the blueprint for the invasion. Joe Biden acted on it. And I tell the story, in fact, the book opens with a scene in the Oval Office in which they're waiting for Bill Burns to, as he's returning from his trip to Moscow on the eve just before the invasion, in which he got on the phone with Vladimir Putin and became convinced that Putin was going ahead, and Burns flew back and briefed Biden and his key advisors. And from that moment forward, Joe Biden really rose to the occasion. He was, I think, better prepared than anyone I can think of to face that moment. He'd spent his entire career really studying the Russians and of course the Soviets and during the Cold War days, and he was uniquely qualified to do this. So they were able to rally skeptical allies. They couldn't really convince them until the invasion took place, but they were able to, in the walk up to the war, prepare Zelensky for what was about to happen. I tell the previously untold story of how Kamala Harris had a private meeting with Zelensky at the Munich Security Conference on the eve of the invasion, which she took him aside privately and told him that not only are the Russians coming for Ukraine, they're coming for you and your family personally. Zelensky was still a skeptic at that point, and when he left the room, she turned to one of her aides and she said, "I wonder if that's the last time we see him alive."
Wow.
This whole thing was closer than anybody realized, but Biden was convinced it was going to happen. And very quickly, on February 24th, 2022, the NATO allies realized that this was real and this was, in effect, their 9/11.
Absolutely. You talked about Bill Burns briefly there, and I'm hoping you can characterize how important it was to have Bill Burns there, who I would put perhaps up there with Ron Newman and Tom Pickering as some of the best placed and well-regarded diplomats of their generation. But now, of course, as CIA director, bringing all of that experience, including his stints of service in Moscow, to bear and being able to be, in a sense, a different, credible channel to try to communicate with Putin and to carry messages back to Washington. So describe Bill Byrne's place in this and how you think it was important to have someone of his background here at the time to help the president make these tough choices about how and whether to release intelligence and prepare allies.
Well, I said it a minute ago that Joe Biden was uniquely prepared to rally the NATO allies and face down Vladimir Putin. You really have to say that Bill Burns was really the perfect person to be CIA director at the time as well, I think. In addition to the diplomats you mentioned, I'd throw in Dick Holbrooke as one of the great ones. Nobody could be less like Holbrooke in terms of his personality. He's measured where Holbrooke was impulsive. But Burns was really uniquely qualified to deal with this for a number of reasons, not only because he was the quintessential diplomat, the most accomplished of his generation, but he knew and knows Vladimir Putin better than anyone other than Putin's inner circle, probably. And he was ready for this moment. In the book, I talk about how he made a secret mission to meet with Zelensky prior to the invasion, and also briefed Putin on the Russian hit squads that were coming to get him. It was Burns' intelligence that helped Zelensky to fend off those attempts on his life. Zelensky also, thanks to Burns, had really the blueprint for the Russian invasion. And when the attack came, the Ukrainians were waiting for them. One of the untold stories in the book is how two Russian transport planes carrying 150 elite Russian paratroopers in each were shot out of the sky in the early days of the invasion. And this was one of the turning points in the battle for Kyiv. The rest, of course, is history. But I tell the story of how that intelligence, the U.S. intelligence campaign to declassify what we knew about the Russian disinformation and their plots that involved, you know, there were outlandish stunts that they were planning involving the use of dead bodies to fake provocations by the Ukrainians and everything else. When Mark Milley briefed President Biden on these, Biden was so appalled and mm-hmm. incredulous that he said, "Can we put this out there? Can we make this public?" To which General Milley replied, "Well, I can't, sir, but you can, and Avril Haines can." That was how that intelligence campaign began, of unmasking Putin's malign plans. And so it was really an impressive performance by the intelligence, maybe one of their finest hours, I think.
There is a bit of a theme here, Chris. You've described Biden as exceptionally well-prepared for this moment. You've described Ron Klain similarly, certainly Bill Burns. There's one other character in this story who hasn't received nearly as much attention as the Afghanistan pullout story and the Ukraine story, and that's John Kerry, working as the climate envoy. Why did you feel it was important to include him in this narrative of big picture stories? And do you think he was also uniquely placed for this moment, especially regarding the Chinese leadership?
Well, I thought John Kerry was an essential character in this book, because when you think about the challenges facing Joe Biden when he took office in January of 2021, global warming is clearly, it's an existential threat. It clearly, you know, belongs along with the pandemic and the crippled economy and the invasion of Ukraine. It's certainly in the same league as a threat. And nobody knows it better than John Kerry. I mean, this is the guy who going back decades as a senator when he was a young man went to school on this subject well before most others, and was the architect, of course, of the Paris Accord under Obama. He was obviously the go-to person on this subject. So I tell the story of how John Kerry tried to negotiate with the Chinese early in the administration and was terribly frustrated by that. He was very close with the Chinese climate envoy, but quickly realized that he wasn't calling the shots anymore. Only Xi could really reach an agreement with the U.S. And so Kerry was frustrated with the Chinese. He was also somewhat frustrated with our own government, the U.S. government, because of all the other things that were competing for Biden's attention, from COVID to Ukraine. So Kerry agitated for a summit between Joe Biden and Xi, and nobody was paying attention to this or telling this story, and nobody really knew this was going on behind closed doors. So I tell that story in the book.
There are so many other stories here, Chris, about national security, but even the wider issues of the presidency, that we'll just have to point people to the book, because we could go on for 45 hours, not just 45 minutes. But I do want to touch on a couple of things quickly. One of them is you have some interesting coverage, I'll say, about the caution with which President Biden has treated his own Secret Service detail. In light of what came out from the January 6th hearings and in the January 6th report about the Secret Service and their interactions with President Trump, I'm hoping you can tell us a little bit about that. Why is it that Biden seems to be so hesitant about giving his full confidence to the Secret Service, and what do you make of it?
This was really stunning to me, David, when I learned it, and I still find it kind of hard to believe. You know, we all think of the Secret Service. You know, I think despite their recent difficulties with a lot of respect, we think of them as people who check their politics at the door before they, you know, protect the president. And I think Joe Biden discovered early on, after becoming president, that you know, a number of the agents in his detail were MAGA sympathizers, and maybe that shouldn't be shocking to anybody who thinks about this, because law enforcement, not just the Secret Service, but law enforcement writ large, is populated by a lot of people with deeply conservative views. But again, we expect the Secret Service not just to protect our presidents, but to keep their secrets. And Biden was not at all sure he could trust them to do so. You know, think about it for a second. For context here, think of how much Trump tried and to some extent succeeded in politicizing that agency. He took the most loyal agent he had, Tony Ornato, and made him deputy, White House deputy chief of staff for operations, a boldly political move that no other president would consider doing. These aren't political people. They're not supposed to be. And that was all you need to know about how Trump regarded the Secret Service. And then think about January 6th, when Mike Pence was in the loading dock at the Capitol, underneath the U.S. Capitol, as a mob was pursuing him and trying to hang him, when he refused to get in his detail's car. He wasn't sure where they were going to take him. He wasn't sure that they weren't part of Trump's plot. You know, that's the kind of context that this was happening in here. And I'm not suggesting that Joe Biden's Secret Service detail is a threat to him physically, but he was troubled by the fact that there were members of his detail that he felt he couldn't trust.
It is disturbing to even think about that and its implications, that's for sure. Let's wrap up, Chris, with some overall thoughts. I will say you have remarkable access to a lot of people here, both in this administration and people who have weighed in with the current administration or have deep perspective on it. There's definitely a I don't know, a positive feeling between all the stories. But for Afghanistan and a couple of others, the general sense one gets from looking at the way you've told the story is that the Biden administration has tackled a lot of things by necessity and tackled a lot of them at the same time by choice. And generally, it sounds like your perspective is they've done a pretty good job with it. Now, a lot of that is from the actors themselves, people telling you, depending on how you spin it, people telling you either excuses for why things didn't work out better or faster, or giving you the rationale and reasoning why. I'm wondering if you can do a little self-reflection at this point and put a wrap on it by describing whether you think overall the Biden administration has done well on these national security and wider issues, or if perhaps because the story isn't fully written yet, that you're prepared to, in a sense, walk back some of that positive feeling that comes through the pages of the book.
Well, I guess I would say this. I really do think, as I mentioned before, that this is a tale of two presidencies, the first year and the second. And the story of the third and fourth year, of course, have yet to be written. The first year was marked by the bungled evacuation of Afghanistan that triggered the long decline in Joe Biden's approval ratings. And I certainly tell the story of that long period of ugly sort of sausage making on Capitol Hill, where he was unable to pass Build Back Better. There's a kind of a dramatic scene when I go to see Ron Klain at the moment when it appeared that Joe Biden's entire legislative agenda was hanging in the balance and maybe this presidency would fail. So I think on balance, I like to think that I take a no holds barred approach to all of Biden's failures during these first 2 years. But once again, at the end of the day, or at least the midway point of this presidency, more accurately, I do think that I think the turning point of this presidency was February 24, 2022, when Putin invaded Ukraine and Biden began to rally NATO to defend a democracy in the heart of Europe and face down Putin. And from there, a lot of successes followed. Legislative victories that rivaled LBJ's, capped by the Inflation Reduction Act, defying the odds in the midterms. So I think Joe Biden does go into the third year of his presidency with the wind at his back. And now you could argue the hard part begins. He's by no means out of the woods because he has to continue to rally NATO to defend Ukraine. He has to avoid a recession and control inflation. He's nowhere near done. But let me also add that I like to think this is not a book just for political junkies either. Some of my favorite parts of the book are the unguarded human moments when when we find out what Joe Biden really thinks about Kamala Harris, his fraught relationship with the Secret Service, what happened on the worst day of his presidency when 13 service members were killed in that terrible suicide bombing in Kabul. As a thunderstorm struck the White House and Joe Biden being his personal anguish when some of the families blamed him for their loss. And so I like to think that this is a book that has something for everyone and not just political junkies, and that at the end of it, I'm pretty balanced about Biden's failures and his successes.
Mm-hmm. I will say that it is remarkable in that it is both a window into the sausage making of policy down to the individual conversations at the tactical level, as well as the strategic thinking going into many different policies, as well as just a human study of Joe Biden and those he's interacting with. Chris, congratulations on the reception so far to your book, The Fight of His Life, and thank you for joining me on the podcast to talk through some of the national security stories in it.
Always a pleasure, David. Thanks for having me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution.
You can get ad-free versions of all Lawfare podcasts that have ads by becoming a material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. That also helps us do what we do, and we appreciate your support. This podcast is edited by Jen Pacha-Howell. Your audio engineer for this episode was Goat Radio's Kara Schillen. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.